This is 89.9 WWNN. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for local humor, as a playwright ponders just what it takes to be a New Orleanian, a sneak peek at a new series by the creator of Mr. Bill from Saturday Night Live, or a look at carnival float art that you can take home. It's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. With Mardi Gras festivities in full swing, New Orleanians and newcomers alike are gearing up for the party of the year. But playwright Jim Fitzmaurice has his sights set beyond the parades and celebrations as he brings back his comedic rant, Be a New Orleanian, a swearing-in ceremony, to remind us why we love this place so much. Jim Fitzmaurice, welcome.
Thank you for having me on.
Be a New Orleanian wherever you are was a cry heard post-Hurricane Katrina as many of us were displaced in cities across America. Did that cry inspire your one-man show?
Yes, it did. And in fact, Dirty Coast is one of the sponsors of the show and has been incredibly helpful. And it was Blake Heaney who came up with that Be a New Orleanian kind of battle cry and roaring cry. You know, one of the things that happened after Katrina and, you know, being 10 years out was people began to show up in the city from all over the country. And many of them became invested in the city deeply. Part of the reason I decided to write the show was that I was moved by the number of people who had come down here and really kind of made an effort. I used to be one of those New Orleanians who, like, you have to live here 10 years and you got to have gone to high school here and then you got to have a secret swearing-in ceremony and all this kind of stuff. I decided to make it a public swearing-in ceremony. And I was kind of moved by all these people who came down here to kind of help out. And so I had this new idea that nobody's got a claim on New Orleans. That unless you are a direct descendant of the Choctaw chief, Pushmataha, you really don't have any claim to say, I'm more New Orleanian than you. And my new attitude is, if you're here for a year and you really love it and you're willing to kind of push in and invest and you're willing to learn and listen rather than explain to us what we need to do better, I don't see any reason why you shouldn't just raise your right hand and be sworn in. And so the whole show is six basic tips, six things you can do to become a New Orleanian, you know, after you're here for the year. There are, by the way, three ways you can become a New Orleanian and not be here a year, but you really don't want to go through any of them. They involve having a gun put in your face, having water up to your ankles, or being walked to the police car and managing without the help of a New Orleanian to talk your way out of going to OPP. If you do any of those three things, you're an instant New Orleanian. Why don't you just wait the year and we'll swear you in after that?
So what about the six tips?
The first one is don't live in Nolens. You want to live in New Orleans, and you can actually come and visit New Orleans, but where you don't want to live is in Nolens. And it's this kind of breakdown about what Nolens is. And I try to tell you that I wish it didn't exist. I wish there was no such place as Nolens, and it was dreamed up by Hollywood swells and had an accent like Scott Bakula and Kathy Bates and John Goodman. But in fact, Nolens does, in fact, exist. And it's divided into two suburbs, Sad Saxophoneville and Spooky Voodoo Land. You know, I mean, we know this place. The joke I make also is that New Orleans is a great place to work and make a living. It's a terrible place to live because you can never have enough. And the whole kind of, you know, the do what you want is what I call them. The do what you want is are kind of a violation of the letter of the rebirth to the Orleanians. It's people who have confused the idea of being wild and crazy as being wild and crazy all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that in New Orleans you can never have enough. You understand that concept?
Yeah.
The idea that we're the people that added caffeine to root beer because, you know, we're the people that actually decided that, you know, simply having a sandwich wasn't enough, that we had to dress it, lather it in mayonnaise, slather. I mean, if you think about what a snowball is, it's a direct refutation of everybody else's snow cones all over the country. Snow cones and slushies don't compare. Wait, think about it. We invented our own machine to create our own kind of ice. We then invented our own kind of syrups, which we then injected with cream, which we then drill a hole in there. We then put soft serve ice cream, put condensed milk all over it, put whipped cream on top of it and call it an old fashioned, and it's still not enough. I mean, we're constantly doing that. And at the pitch point of that particular part of the show, it all kind of culminates with Chip from Des Moines covered head to toe in beignet sugar racing down Bourbon Street declaring his fealty to St. Patrick of O'Brien. And that's Nolens. That is a manufactured place that a lot of people come down looking to find. I think the people that stay discover a place called New Orleans, the actual place that's down here. And so part of what it is, it's encouraging these people to come down here, and here are six things you can do. And the first one is don't live in New Orleans. Well, I'll give it away the entire show. The second one I also just adore is Smile, Your Life Just Might Depend on It. And this kind of answers the question as to why New Orleanians are constantly smiling. And then I break the smile down into five different distinctive types. The reason we smile so much is that we're surrounded by a thousand terrible things down here, because the only alternative to, like, giving up in despair is to keep smiling. I mean, you think about what is surrounding the city of New Orleans without even getting to the city of New Orleans. If you don't smile, you'd probably go somewhat insane.
So we smile.
So we smile. Your life just might depend on it. You might actually smile your way out of a mugging.
Do you actually perform a naturalization ceremony in your monologue?
At the end of the show, I make the audience come to its feet, raise its right hand, and then I say, by the power vested in myself, I then make them say the six elements. I swear you're going to do certain things, like you promise you will believe at least one BS story a year. There's always somebody that tells you a crazy, ridiculous, over-the-top, that couldn't have possibly happened story about what happened to them in New Orleans. And then 3 weeks later, you run into somebody who completely verifies it. So it's like crucial, you know. The other thing you'll like is the blinker. You know why New Orleanians don't use their blinkers?
You mean the turn signal?
Yeah. You know why they don't do it?
No.
Why is it your business what I'm doing? And the other problem is, too, if you use your blinker in New Orleans, the person in the lane behind you speeds up. I mean, Artie from Avondale turns into Dr. David Bruce Banner exposed to gamma radiation. They turn into the Hulk. They try and run you off the road. You know what I'm saying? It's the same thing with merging in town. I mean, trying to merge in town is like trying to get a front row spot on Orleans Avenue for the Endymion Parade. I mean, people have been there. People aren't giving up their lane in town. I also make the joke, too, that smiling is the price we pay for the way we drive. I think people just smile all the time. They're always happy. They're always in a joyful mood. And then they get in their cars in New Orleans and, you know.
And things change.
And things change. Things change. So we answer the question of why the question, where'd you go to high school, gets asked. I'm hoping that people who are New Orleanians recognize the jokes, and the people who are not from New Orleans feel like they're learning something about what the city is. Because at the end of the show, I tell a New Orleans version of the prodigal son, and I say one of the things that always concerns us is that people are worried with all these new people coming into town, and lots of new people coming into town, that something will change. Well, New Orleans has always been bringing new people to town. That's what New Orleans is, bringing new people to town. We just got to make sure that the jokes that we tell in a show like mine, and the jokes that people like Chris Rose or Chris Champagne or a number of people who also are talking about New Orleans all the time, that people keep getting the jokes. Because the saddest thing would be is somebody to look at Vic and Natalie, you know, Bunny Matthews, Vic and Natalie, to sit down 25 years from now, open that book and read it and be living in New Orleans and not get it.
That would be sad.
That would be sad. That's what we're trying to prevent. I think a lot of us have to stop worrying about whether or not this person has been here for 5 years or 7 or 10 or 15 and worry about them actually understanding. Like I said, if you get the jokes in Vic Natalie, you're fine. If Ronnie Virgit's accent is funny to you, you're fine. It's about getting it. There's a wonderful theater artist who once said that New Orleans lets you be, so you owe her the courtesy of letting her be as well.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's New Orleans.
Wish I had written that. That's New Orleans. That's terrific. Yeah. I hope when people come and see the show, they say, oh, it's shows like this reminding me why I live here that make me feel I'm happy to live here.
This is a new theater venture for you?
The theater at St. Claude used to be the Marigny Theater. It's behind the Always Lounge. It has a separate entrance. My brother Ryan and I pushed in there last May. And we have insulated the ceilings, carpeted the backstage area, bought 90 new seats, and just announced our new season. We think we found our niche. It's kind of crazy running the theater where it's this rollover of new work and new people kind of pouring in and out of it all the time.
Well, congratulations on the new theater, on your new season. Playwright Jim Fitzmaurice, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you very much.
Dirty Coast presents Be a New Orleanian, a swearing-in ceremony by Jim Fitzmaurice, with performances running February 12th through 29th at the Theater at St. Claude, 2240 St. Claude Avenue. A look at New Orleans through turbulent years starting in the late 1950s is about to debut this weekend at the Britannia Theater. Eileen Fleming reports it's the first glimpse of an intricate project that ends with the assassination of President Kennedy.
Does this sound familiar?
I'll give you a lift over to the construction site.
Oh, come on, Mr. Hand. Why'd you leave us so long? Oh.
Off we go.
The That's Poor Mr. Bill, the little clay creation featured in short films on Saturday Night Live starting in 1976. They're the creation of New Orleans native Walter Williams. He's been busy working on 5 seasons in a series about New Orleans that begins in 1958. It's called Crescent City, and Dr. John scored the theme. Sets the scene for storylines that converged in New Orleans in substantial ways and includes crime bosses, rock and roll, civil rights, the Cuban Revolution, and the rise of John F. Kennedy. It's tied together through one character called Kevin. Here's a scene from the first episode of Crescent City, filmed at the Show Bar.
Well, this little cutie wants to leave the USSR, and you are a ticket out of there. All you have to do is bring her back over here as Mrs. Lee Harvey Oswald.
I'm too young to settle down.
It's funny, wise guy. When you get back, everything will be forgotten, and you will have some nice memories.
Why?
She's full of intel. Her uncle's some rocket scientist. Sputnik, maybe.
Here, Williams sits in his living room, which is used in the filming, and explains the concept. What's previewing at the Britannia, and how did that come about?
Well, I started this process about 5 years ago. I got the idea that it would be really interesting and entertaining to do a show about the Kennedy assassination in New Orleans, because I'm from here, I witnessed the whole event, which changed my life, and I've always been, Lee Harvey Oswald lived down the street. So anyway, about 5 years ago, I got the idea that this would be a really great dramatic show. And not only that, being in New Orleans, with there was the civil rights movement going on. It was the beginnings of rock and roll. It was still one of the biggest thriving cities in the country and in the South. So I decided, I'm going to try to put this together. So I sat down and wrote the first script, and then it went very well. I developed my lead character, who's a fictitious character, but he integrates with all these recognizable JFK figures like Lee Harvey Oswald, who's a friend of his, and Jack Ruby. And so we go back to 1958, 5 years before the assassination, and we see how this all evolves over the years.
The distribution system, the production system, it has all changed since Mr. Bill made his debut on network television.
Right.
Talk about the process and how it's changed over the years.
It hasn't changed for me. I come up with an idea and figure out how to make it. But back when I started, there were only 3 ways to get your work to the public, and that was ABC, CBS, or NBC. So today, there's obviously a lot more than 3. In fact, cable is now on its way out, and most young people these days don't even buy cable. They buy internet, high-speed internet, and either a tablet or a smart TV. A smart TV now comes built in with options to play movies from around the world. That's one way. That's on-demand distribution. I'm still looking for a network cable deal. But, Hollywood's very compartmentalized, and I'm the Mr. Bill guy at best, So you're not going to, when I even bring this stuff up, it doesn't fit into their pattern. So I realized early on this was not a viable option to go to a network, because they would not let me do the show, number one. If they liked the show, their first job would be how to get rid of me,
What's the purpose of showing the 26 minutes that you have shot at the Britannia?
Mainly for the actors and the crew and the people involved, the supporters, to see what we've actually been able to do. And so with 25 minutes of episode 1, I'm pretty close to doing a full hour episode. So I'm hoping by presenting this 25 minutes of finished material in 4K on a big screen and show the quality of production and acting, along with my 10 episodes of finished screenplays for season 1, and I have synopses for the people who don't want to read them all. I've got cliff notes if you want to see how my story goes. I'm hoping that by seeing this footage, seeing the scripts, seeing the cast and crew, that a network will step up and give me the meager amount of money to film this season 1. They'll have control then of the show. Say HBO were to license it, they'd have rights to show season 1 and the rights to do more, 4 more seasons. So if it doesn't work out, they can cut their losses there. if it works out, they've hit a home run. They've got control of a five-season new franchise that everyone's excited about, knowing that if they keep watching this, you might figure out who killed Kennedy. And who doesn't want to know that, really?
Who killed Kennedy?
Tune in to episode 50.
Walter Williams, thank you very much.
Thanks for talking to me about it.
The segment of episode 1 of Crescent City debuts Saturday at 10 a.m. It's free and open to the public. For Inside the Arts, I'm Eileen Fleming.
You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. Well, did you enjoy the parades over the weekend? Yes? Can you name an artist who may have handcrafted the art that adorned your favorite float? I didn't think so. Well, that's about to change as a group of independent artists who have been working behind the scenes are going high profile. They have formed the Carnival Collective and are making it possible for you to take home a piece of Mardi Gras float art. Joining me now is artist Randy Morrison and art boutique owner Angie Jackson. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Hi.
What inspired you and other artists to come from behind the scenes in this Carnival Collective?
It's surprising to me that most people in the city aren't even aware of the artists who make the work. And Angie had the brilliant idea of creating a display at her shop where we could show some of the finest examples of what we create for parades and get people familiar with what we do and who we are.
And who are the members of the collective?
Right now it's myself and Dana Bueller and Caroline Thomas and Brian Bush. We're all experienced Mardi Gras artists who've been in the trade for several years. I've been in it for at least 15. I've done some of the work for Endymion and the crew of Hermes and some of the other major crews. And we've innovated a lot of interesting techniques that people have never seen, except in the parades that we do. And Angie gave us an opportunity to show off some of our highest skills so that people can enjoy it year-round.
Now, you are one of the co-founders of the Carnival Collective.
That's right.
Angie, are you also a co-founder, or are you not a part of that collective?
She's on the board. She helps guide us.
I think I do most of the business stuff for them.
So in helping the artist to become more high profile, you are showcasing some of the
yes.
Mardi Gras float art in your boutique, Miette?
Yes.
Tell us about that, and let's begin with the name Miette. Does it mean something?
Yes, it does. Miette means little sister or niece in Cajun French, actually.
Uh-huh.
and regular French, it means crumb or little piece of, because I'm little. I just want to have a little piece of things.
So what will we see in the boutique? This is eclectic art?
Yeah, as of right now, we currently have Randy's sculptures, and we have flowers made by Brian and Dana and Caroline and Gabriella. Gabriella Bruno is another artist that works with them. The flowers are covering everything right now. They're adorning the entire ceiling almost and one of the walls, so it looks almost like a wonderland.
It's also populated with these giant flying insects that we created for the parade and some Mardi Gras headdresses made by Caroline Thomas. So there's quite a variety.
And I understand there's an interactive feature in the boutique?
Yeah, Randy hung his insects in the store in a way that you can stand in certain spots and get a selfie with one of his bees or butterflies so that it looks like the bee is my favorite. The bee, whenever you stand in front of him, he looks like he's coming after you.
I've got an illuminated firefly, fairly large. It's about 2 or 3 feet in length. And I use multimedia processes that you never see really anywhere else in Mardi Gras. I've got monocoat wings, so they're transparent, and hand-painted veins in the wings. I've got a lightweight casting material that allows me to make fairly large pieces, like the gargoyle that I have on chimneys and like synagogue on Jackson Street. And it's tough, but it's very lightweight, so you can hang it from your ceiling. And there's brass limbs and antenna. Some of the eyes light up. With the firefly, the eyes and the tail lights up. I've got transparent wings on the butterflies because they're made out of a sort of a sheer nylon material. So you can see the pattern, but you can also see through them, so they feel very light. It's pretty unique kind of work. And it's the kind of techniques that I learned in the film industry and in theme parks and casino work, and I want to apply some of the most cutting-edge materials and processes to Carnival because we have a lot of room to make Carnival more beautiful. And with the talented artists that I'm working with, we have a real chance to bring it back, that 19th century glory, that was world class. It would dazzle people. It was like a rolling exhibit of fine art on the street every year. And we can do that level of work, but we need the public to help us. And we need to draw upon the love of the public for the parades. And the way that we're doing that is we're kind of creating a partnership with them. We're saying, come take a look at the beautiful work that we make for the floats. If you love it, take it home with you. And we will use those resources to subsidize more ambitious work for the parades so that when you come out here to enjoy Carnival, you'll see more beautiful parades than you've ever seen before.
Is it tedious work?
Never tedious. It is extremely demanding. I mean, the quality level that we want to achieve demands a lot of focus, a lot of time. Sometimes I work 36-hour shifts to get a project done. And that's because I don't want it going out the door if it's not going to inspire people.
If we were on a parade route right now and there were a float passing by, how would we know that it was your signature float?
Well, first of all, you'd notice the sculpture because I'm the only sculptor in Carnival doing very classical, lifelike, figurative work. But you'll also notice that it's in a setting. It's almost like the character is within a Renaissance-style painting. The paintwork, the decorations, the sculpture, they're all integrated to create a tableau. In the 19th century, they called this a tableau roulant. It's a rolling tableau. It's like a theater stage on wheels. And that's the kind of style that I'm trying to bring back to Carnival.
What is your hope as you go high profile in preserving this local art form?
I'm hoping that we'll start something of a forest fire of creativity in competition across the city. A lot of the major parades are kind of languishing because there isn't enough creative competition within Carnival. And I'm hoping that by inspiring other artists and the crowds and getting the attention that the parades really would love to share with the public, that more parades will want to do more ambitious artwork. And they'll start focusing more on the beauty of the floats rather than the bounty of the throws. The rise of throw culture has kind of overturned the creative legacy of Carnival. Something like 10 times as much money is spent on throws as on the float decorations themselves. So that we're working with very stringent limitations. And that's one of the reasons why Angie's idea was so brilliant, is that if we can bring the artwork to the public in a way that they can take something home with them, then if they buy that, we can use that money to finance the materials and the processes and the time that it takes to do this really ambitious work that's just not in the budget anymore.
Artist Randy Morrison and Miette Art Boutique owner Angie Jackson, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you for having us.
Mardi Gras float art by the Carnival Collective is available for public collection at Miette Art Boutique, 2038 Magazine Street in the Lower Garden District. That's our show for this week. Inside the Arts is a production of WWNO. Our program is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next Tuesday at 1 p.m. when we'll go Inside the Arts. I'm Diane Mack.